Don't look now, but healthcare? It's back. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 17th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. All right, maybe I oversold it just a tad. It's not like the whole repeal and replace debate is back yet, but Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee, and the chairman of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, and Welfare, and Democrat Patty Murray of Washington, the ranking member of said panel, said today they have come to an agreement that restores the cost-sharing reductions, the subsidies for low-income consumers in the individual insurance market that President Trump cut off last week, and in the process, basically stabilizing Obamacare. Interestingly, speaking in the Rose Garden today, the president said he's all right with that.
But it is a short-term solution so that we don't have this very dangerous little period, including dangerous period for insurance companies, by the way. For a period of 1 year, 2 years, we will have a very good solution, but we're going to have a great solution ultimately for health care. Okay? And they are working together, and I know very much what they're doing. Okay? Thank you.
There is, of course, the small matter of actual votes in both chambers on this thing. The president also said today, by the way, he wants to get back to health care after the GOP's tax plan is wrapped up. The word of the day on taxes, since you asked, is deficits. The Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center estimates that Republican tax cuts could blow a $2.4 trillion hole in the federal budget, a figure that would have struck fear into the hearts of GOP deficit hawks of old. But as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, most of those hawks have gone quiet or are singing a totally different tune.
A group of hawks is called a kettle. And in D.C., just a handful of years ago, the kettle was riled up.
The answer to getting back on the right fiscal track is spending less, not borrowing more.
That level of borrowing, that level of spending is just not acceptable.
That was Republican Representatives Scott Desjarlais and Tom Reed back in 2011. Lots of GOP lawmakers were ringing the same alarms. Today, D.C. just doesn't have the same focus. Dave Walker is former U.S. Comptroller General.
And unfortunately, the champions, both on the Republican and the Democratic side, both in the executive and the legislative branch, have largely left the scene.
So where'd all those deficit hawks go?
That is a question I have been asking myself.
Maya McGinnis is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
There are many people who made fiscal responsibility the central theme of why they wanted to come to Congress, and they're about to pass legislation that will make the debt worse.
There are a couple reasons for the seeming GOP change of heart. For one, fiscal responsibility means making tough, unpopular choices like raising taxes or cutting spending. Politicians from both parties also seem to care way more about the deficit when they're in the opposition. Historian Elliot Brownlee from UC Santa Barbara says Republicans have made this costume change before. Tax cutter to deficit hawk, back to tax cutter.
It's a tactical flip-flop.
He thinks the deficits that could result from a massive tax cut could be used in the future to justify a pullback in spending on programs the party has long opposed, bringing the hawks back out. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Here with a quote from U.S. trade negotiator Robert Lighthizer today as the fourth round of NAFTA negotiations wrapped up, the contentious fourth round, I ought to say. Lighthizer said that if President Trump does pull out of the deal, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico will, quote, do just fine. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has the update on where things stand.
Trump's trade team floated several non-starter proposals that even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has labeled poison pills. Chief among them, says Laura Dawson, who runs the Wilson Center's Canada Institute, is a sunset clause that would kill NAFTA unless it's renegotiated every 5 years.
To me, it looks like the Snapchat of trade agreement provisions, where it's just going to cause the agreement to dissolve, which is exactly what we don't want from trade agreements.
Dawson also says Canada and Mexico have been seeking more access to U.S. government procurement contracts, but the U.S. is pushing an America First policy there.
Which is not only worse than what they've got now, it would give Bahrain better procurement access to the United States than Canada and Mexico have.
Then there's Trump's solution for the auto trade deficit, a change to what's called rules of origin, which say what portion of a product must be made in a NAFTA country to avoid import taxes. The U.S. wants the percentage up from 62% to 85%, and it wants 50% made solely within the U.S. Gustavo Flores Macias teaches government at Cornell University.
If we consider these percentages as positions that the U.S. would not move from, then the agreement is likely to fail.
Overall, Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute for International Economics says the controversial proposals are central to Trump's trade philosophy, but bad deals for our trading partners.
I don't see how Canada or Mexico could accept them and could wither the popular storm of opposition. So this is the classic rock and a hard place.
Should be fun and games for round 5 in Mexico City early next month. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, Dow 23K, almost. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Hours, give or take, until the application deadline for one of the great corporate bonanzas of our day, Amazon's HQ2, the company's second standalone headquarters, which Amazon promises will bring with it 50,000 mid to high paying central office jobs and a whole lot of steel and glass square footage in the city upon which Jeff Bezos bestows his favor. It's a bidding war gone hog wild, as you might imagine. Tax incentives, subsidies, favorable zoning, job training, and all the rest are on offer. Portland and Denver and Newark, New Jersey and Charlotte, North Carolina and a whole lot of other million-plus population metropolitan areas are in the running. And there is a lot at economic stake. But how much, really, are 50,000 jobs worth? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Maybe this pitch-a-thon to Amazon is getting a little out of hand. There are the promotional videos, this one from Frisco, Texas, a suburb of Dallas.
Amazon, you're growing your business, and we want to grow with you.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie just cut to the chase, offering $7 billion in tax incentives if Amazon chooses Newark for its HQ2 and those 50,000 jobs. So is it all worth it?
You can't say just offhand, no deal is good or every deal is good.
Fred Trays runs Regional Economic Models, Inc., and his firm provides software that state and local officials use to crunch the cost and benefit numbers. To start with, Amazon says the jobs will pay on average $100,000 a year.
For each one of those jobs, there's all the expenditure of the employee's income, law firms, accounting firms, and the other businesses that are brought in.
Salaries for all those new workers, that's on the plus side of the economic ledger. There will be new service workers, like teachers, that also represent a cost to taxpayers, says Megan Randall at the Urban Institute.
People come with their families, so there will be additional children to educate. There are more people using public transit. There are more people using roads.
Critics say the billions in tax breaks to lure a company like Amazon almost never outweigh the long-term burden on taxpayers. But Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute says it's in the long run that a city's most likely to benefit.
A city establishing itself as a place where there's technological innovation happening for talented college graduates to move to in future years.
And he says those benefits will probably be worth more than the 50,000 new Amazon jobs coming to town. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This being Tuesday, I'm taking my trash cans and recycling bins to the curb tonight, me and a zillion other people in this country, because waste is pretty much the end result of a lot of what this economy generates. The problem is that all that stuff has to go somewhere, which is becoming more difficult. Erica Phillips wrote about the global recycling economy in the Wall Street Journal. Erica, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We should say here, just to remind everybody, we are the biggest waste producer in the world.
Correct.
Okay. Where does it all go?
Well, myriad places. But the story I wrote about dealt with our recycling,
yes.
Which, you know, your curbside stuff
yep.
gets collected every week, ideally by a municipal program of some sort. A large portion of that gets actually packed down into bales and shipped on container ships to Asia, where it gets turned into consumer goods that come back here to the U.S. So kind of a circular economy happening.
And the story is now that China, which has been the recipient of so much of our recyclable scrap over the past number of years, has said, in essence, we don't really want it anymore.
That's right. This is a huge wrench in the whole system. So plastic, paper goes over to China. It gets made into cardboard and toys and things like that. But China, it just so happens, is becoming a much more prosperous economy. And they've got a lot of stuff of their own, packaging that comes with things that their own residents are buying and consuming. They've decided, actually, you know what, world? No more scrap coming our way. No more paper. No more plastic. We're done.
So what are we going to do with it all? I mean, you set a scene down at the Port of Long Beach where it's just piling up there.
Yeah, there are actually in the L.A. Long Beach area, I've talked to folks who are having to rent out a whole 60,000 square foot warehouse just to stick their bales of cardboard and plastic for the time being until they figure out customers maybe in other countries or potentially the U.S. industry for using scrap material to make into new goods starts building up, building back up again.
Yeah. There is also a global trade deficit story, actually, in this, in that you say in this piece, you know, container ships that come over here from China full of toys and computers and whatever it is, they would otherwise go back empty were it not for this scrap we've been sending. So there is a little bit of it's very circular.
Yeah, every month about, and I track this, the L.A. and Long Beach ports bring in about 750,000 20-foot equivalent containers filled with stuff.
Yeah.
And on the back route, going back to Asia, where it's all primarily coming from, a lot of times there's just not anything to really put in there because we're consuming it all. We're sending back the containers to basically get refilled with the next round of stuff.
Yeah.
But without that destination on the backhaul, that all kind of breaks down.
The amount of time that the folks down at the Port of Long Beach and Los Angeles can let that stuff pile up in their warehouses is finite, right? When are they going to run into serious trouble and need to do something with it?
There is quite a bit of space here in the good old United States. Stuff's piling up. But they're finding another place for it. At least, you know, this one company I spoke to that's getting the 60,000 square foot warehouse, he doesn't anticipate that he's going to need it for longer than 6 months. He's getting a short term lease. So ideally, they're going to find other customers. They're going to figure out where that stuff's going to go.
The other fix to this, obviously, is that we just waste and discard less stuff.
We waste and discard less stuff, or we put stuff on the curbside, the recyclers pick it up, and it ends up in a landfill.
Right.
If this 60,000 square foot warehouse, for example, fills up and it ends up not having anywhere to go, it's probably going to go to landfill.
Erica Phillips, writing in the Wall Street Journal on our scrap economy. Erica, thanks a lot.
Thanks. It was fun to be here.
Coming up.
For asteroid mining, maybe to spend $100 billion to do it. So there has to be a pretty good risk assessment.
Yes, yes, there does. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 40 points today, a 10%, ended at 22,997. It did cross 23K during the day, though. The NASDAQ unchanged, 6623. S&P 500 gained a point, less than a 10%, 25.59. Healthcare stocks rallied on that news of CSRs that we started with. United Health Group, the nation's biggest health insurer, perked up 5.5% today. That on mostly better-than-expected third-quarter earnings. Johnson & Johnson jumped up 3.4%. Aetna up 2.9%. Aircraft maker Boeing down 0.4% today after European rival Airbus took a majority stake in Bombardier's new passenger jets. Airbus up 4.8%. Bonds up just a tetch. Yield on the 10-year T-note steady at 2.30%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There have been so far in Greater Houston almost 900,000 people who've registered with FEMA for federal disaster assistance. About 300,000 of those applications have been approved, direct cash payments to people who were affected by the storm. Only citizens or legal residents are eligible for the money, but Houston is home to about 500,000 undocumented people who have now been left to find help in other ways. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on that from Houston.
Outside a sprawling apartment complex in northwest Houston, I meet Ingrid. Like a lot of the people in this neighborhood, she's Latina and was displaced by Hurricane Harvey. We're not using her full name because of her immigration status. She found this unflooded one-bedroom apartment through a friend. She's living here indefinitely. It's her and her four kids, ages 12, 10, 6, and 3 months. She says the night of August 25th, she woke up to the sound of water rushing into her old apartment just a few blocks away. She knew they had to get out.
We lost everything that night and next day. We walked to the car and slept there for a while because we didn't have any other place to stay.
The flood came at a particularly tough time. Ingrid's husband was deported back to his home country of Mexico just a week before Harvey hit, after being stopped for a traffic incident.
My life right now isn't easy.
Ingrid came to Houston from Honduras 12 years ago, met her husband, and started a family. Undocumented people like her are eligible for some government help, basically emergency food and shelter, after a disaster like Harvey. But they're not eligible for FEMA cash assistance, up to $33,000 per household, or low-interest government loans to rebuild homes. If a family is mixed status with children who were born here, their undocumented parents can apply for federal disaster relief assistance on behalf of the kids. That's the case for Ingrid's family, so she gave it a shot.
I filled out an application with FEMA, but they still haven't responded. They haven't sent me anything. They've told me nothing. I don't have any idea what happened with that application. I've been to various organizations, but none of them helped me.
The FEMA application for her kids doesn't require Ingrid to declare her immigration status, but she says she's still worried about being targeted by immigration authorities if she applies for any aid from the government. She says she was willing to take the risk to help her children. Right after Harvey hit, nonprofits set up shop in shelters to help undocumented people and Spanish speakers. But with shelters now closed, help is harder to find. A group called United We Dream identified several families in dire need of help. Ingrid's was one. They connected her to a nonprofit that raised money online for Harvey relief. Donna Murphy is chair of that nonprofit, a women's group. She felt great about writing a $5,000 check for Ingrid, but there was a snag. Ingrid doesn't have a bank account or a USID. Murphy agreed to help her get the check cashed.
So she took that $5,000 check and went to like some check cashing place, and they told her that we declined it, but we can't tell you why. It bounced in the system, and now she's locked out of the system.
Murphy says she and Ingrid tried 10 check cashing stores. None would take it. So the group took back the check, and after a week of wrangling, gave Ingrid $5,000 in cash.
And she's okay with that. I'm a little bit uncomfortable with it because it's a large amount of cash.
Murphy says for her, it underscores the constant challenges for the undocumented community.
Everything that could go wrong and like that many of us just take for granted that are so easy, that takes so little time and thought and energy for anybody else, is just like so impossible for her.
A week or so after our interview, Murphy called with an update about Ingrid. Ingrid sent some of the $5,000 cash to Honduras to pay for a breathing machine for her mother. She told Murphy she went to a FEMA office in Houston to check on the application for her kids. Ingrid was ill at the time and says a worker told her to come back when she wasn't sick. Apparently, she refused to leave, and eventually the police were called. In a voicemail, Murphy says Ingrid's just giving up on money from FEMA.
She told me that she's not going back, that she doesn't want anything to do with it anymore.
Murphy says instead, Ingrid's going to have to rely on friends and charity donations. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We're going to take a detour here for a little bit to the not all too distant future to see what technologies might, maybe, could possibly shake up the economy and help determine the future of our species. Kelly Wiener-Smith is a scientist. She's a biologist by training. Her husband, Zach Wiener-Smith, does comics, Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal among them. Their new book is called Soon-ish, 10 Emerging Technologies That'll Improve and or Ruin Everything, sort of a layman's explainer mashed up with a comic book. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
So, I'm going to start with this. Soon-ish, the title, Kelly. It seems appropriately vague so as not to get you into any trouble.
Well, we were very noncommittal about when these technologies were going to come to fruition. And a big theme of the book is that it's really hard to predict that kind of stuff because technology doesn't always make stepwise progression. Sometimes you have big discontinuous leaps, which make it really hard to predict. And then there's things like economics that can get in the way that you didn't necessarily think about when you were the engineer starting the project.
So let's talk about some of these things in the book. The first couple, and you put it in one section, is the universe soonish. You talk about space travel. You talk about asteroid mining. And the interesting thing for me on this one, Kelly, was this section is all economics.
Yeah. So that was an interesting thing that we didn't necessarily anticipate going in, was just how important economics is for a lot of this stuff. And, you know, at the end of the day, if the technology doesn't have a market or the market isn't working the way you anticipated it was, then a technology isn't going to work out. And so there's all sorts of market forces that can sort of mess with an engineer or a scientist's plans.
And also, Zach, I mean, if we go asteroid mining for all these rare metals and we bring them all back to Earth somehow, we flood the market and the price falls. And where's the incentive there?
Yeah, and it's unpredictable. That's what's interesting. I mean, so in terms of how humanity is doing, if you found an asteroid full of platinum, which you probably won't, to be clear, but if you did, you would probably crash the market. Humanity might be better off because we'd have a cheap catalyst. But, you know, this stuff doesn't happen if there's no good market. You know, you have to have people willing for asteroid mining maybe to spend $100 billion to do it.
Right.
So there has to be a pretty good risk assessment.
So do you think, actually, just to sidetrack a little bit here, what do you think about Elon Musk and all that he's doing in this area of technology?
Well, that is a fascinating question. He's clearly doing amazing things to make access to space very cheap. He didn't return our calls, unfortunately. We would have loved to have talked to him about that. So he's clearly the leader in this area, and he wants to get to Mars sometime soon and set a colony up out there. That could be an entire different book, but the implications of that and what it's going to mean when we have people on Mars and they're so far away that you can't talk to them quickly or reach them for years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Zach, one of the things you guys point out in this book is that we are not keeping up with our technological advances. And you talk about robotic construction and how we have the technology to do a bunch of this stuff, and we're just not.
Robotics has been one of these fields that we've been very excited about for a long time, and it just seems to never quite come. So we actually found a paper about robotic construction, about the experiments Japan did with it in the 80s and 90s. Japan is a very aging culture. I think the average age in Japan is like 46 now, quite old. And so the idea of a robot labor force is quite appealing. And at least in the papers we found, it seemed like it was kind of a wash. So you can kind of imagine it. You have a construction worker and you give him this robot that's supposed to help. And it helps by the time he knows how it works. But by the time you get there, you've lost all this time training yourself on a new machine or dealing with the robot's deficiencies. So there's a great deal of appeal here. I say that as someone who's staring down the barrel of home ownership shortly.
Oh, good luck, man.
Yeah, I like the idea that a robot swarm just makes the house materialize for the cost of parts. Whether that'll happen soon and what the economic implications are, that's kind of a scary question.
Kelly, when you sat down to think about what's realistic and what's not with some of these technologies, and we're going from bioprinting to basically chips in our brains to robotic construction, all that stuff, what was your over-under on how like realistic they are? Did you say, this one's promising but not realistic, we're not putting it in there?
Well, for all of the technologies that you listed, people have been working on them for quite a while. And there, you know, there were people we could find online, like for bioprinting, for example, who had managed to print blood vessels that looked promising, like they could maybe one day provide nutrients to a liver, for example. It had to be far enough along that we could see that progress was being made. And then, you know, our gut had to tell us that there was some chance that it would work out. But we could be wrong.
Well, and there's the hedge again, right? There's the waffle. I'm just saying that's where we started. That's where we're ending, right?
Indeed.
Kelly and Zach Wiener-Smith, their book is called Soonish, 10 Emerging Technologies That'll Improve and or Ruin Everything. Thanks a lot.
It sounds so great when you say it.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks
Thank
a lot.
You.
This final note on the way out today, it took him almost a week, but FCC Chairman Ajit Pai has finally weighed in on President Trump's tweet of 6 days ago. The president saying he wanted to challenge the licenses of broadcasters that report stories critical of the White House and its policies. Here's Ajit Pai.
I believe in the First Amendment. The FCC, under my leadership, will stand for the First Amendment. And under the law, the FCC does not have the authority to revoke a license of a broadcast station based on the content of a particular newscast.
I'm just going to leave that right there, huh? All right, we're out. Dow 23K was the phrase of the day on Wall Street today, closed just shy. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcoat, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.